Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, the Vatican releases the text of Pope Benedict's message for the upcoming World Peace Day as a high-level conference on climate change continues in Copenhagen. That's right, you guessed it. Protecting God's creation is the theme. But what does that have to do with world peace? Stay with us to find out. And what was an apostle in biblical times? And where did Christ's followers end up after his death and resurrection? You might be surprised to learn just how far some of them traveled. Nature gone haywire, flooding, droughts, horrifying hurricanes, and terrifying tornadoes, rising sea levels. Negotiators on a new pact to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are debating the consequences of unchecked global warming on our planet. Famine, rising immigration, and war loom on the horizon, say delegates to this week's climate change conference in Copenhagen, and countries must cut back on pollutants now. Coinciding with the conference, the Holy See has released the text of Pope Benedict XVI's message for the upcoming World Peace Day, celebrated January 1st each year. The theme for 2010, if you want to cultivate peace, protect creation. The text of the message was released at a press conference in the Vatican Tuesday. Chris Altieri has more.
Titled, If You Want Peace, Protect Creation, Pope Benedict XVI's message for the celebration of World Peace Day is a reflection on the profound connection between the urgent tasks of peacemaking and stewardship of the natural order. The message places itself in the tradition of papal reflections and addresses on various aspects of stewardship, including Paul VI's early call to be mindful of the dangers of ill-considered exploitation of nature, to John Paul II's 1990 World Peace Day message titled Peace with God the Creator, Peace with All Creation, in which his predecessor warned of the dangers attendant upon a lack of due respect for nature and called for development of ecological awareness and concrete initiatives expressive of that awareness. Pope Benedict's latest message also touches on the need for prudentially guided long-term vision and intergenerational solidarity. The World Day of Peace is this coming January 1st, 2010. I'm Chris Altieri.
Emerge allora un primo essenziale aspetto del messaggio di Benedetto XVI, il quale ci propone una visione cosmica.
Well, at Tuesday's press conference, Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, President Emeritus of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, hailed Pope Benedict's message as offering a cosmic vision of peace, which strikes a harmonious balance between God, humanity, and creation.
Benedetto XVI denuncia una vera e propria crisi ecologica.
The Cardinal went on to say that Pope Benedict denounces a veritable ecological crisis deriving from climate change, desertification, the degrading and loss of productivity of farmland, the pollution of rivers and oceans, and the increase in extreme weather phenomena. These, in turn, lead to a new kind of environmental refugee and can lead to conflicts over natural resources. The Pope's message, said Cardinal Martino, calls for profound ethical and cultural renewal. These crisis situations, whether they be economic, nutritional, environmental, or social crises, are also, the Pope affirms, moral crises. We are all responsible for protecting creation, and the Pope encourages families to begin educating their children to be ecologically friendly, starting in the home.
Come afferma Benedetto XVI, è infatti importante riconoscere.
Cardinal Martino noted that the Pope recognizes the historical responsibility of industrialized nations in creating the current ecological crisis, and in doing so, however, he does not exonerate less developed and emerging countries from adopting effective environmental measures and policies.
Benedetto XVI ci offre una lettura realistica e assai problematica, eppure mai catastrofica.
Finally, Cardinal Martino observed that Benedict XVI offers us a realistic and problematic, yet never catastrophic, view of the current environmental crisis. The Holy Father, he said, stresses the negative aspects of human conduct, but without ever losing hope in the intelligence and dignity of man. Well, thousands of delegates and environmental activists attending the Copenhagen summit are working on a framework that would determine how much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases each industrialized country should be allowed to produce, and how much big developing countries like China and India should aim at restraining the growth in their emissions. I asked Monsignor James Reinert of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace if media attention on the world financial crisis means global warming has dropped off the radar screen, and why it should continue to concern us.
I think, in a way, it hasn't made the idea of climate change go away. It has, in many ways, brought it to the forefront. The changes in gasoline usage, petroleum usage in the last, especially in the last few months, but in the last couple of years, shows a sign that there is more awareness. Now, with the dropping of the prices of oil that we saw last summer, is that going to mean that people are going to feel more free to use more petroleum? Or is there an awareness now that there has to be something done? So I think that the two are going to go together, because for funding, for charitable giving, for all of these things, for programs that might combat climate change or at least study the cause and effects, science might see a downturn in those kind of things. So maybe there's a greater urgency in dealing with the climate change question in light of the financial situation that we see the world.
As the price of oil has continued to fluctuate in recent years, most of us realize it's only a question of time before there won't be any left. Will there be enough for our children or our children's children? Why can't we find alternatives to oil and coal? Much attention has been given recently to alternative energy sources like biofuels, but are they a magic wand or a Pandora's box?
From the information that I see and from many of the reports that we see coming across, that biofuels might be more of a problem than the overuse of petroleum products. In the United States, at least, I'm aware that there was a real question on the use of water and how much water it was going to take to produce the biofuels, rather to grow the crops and in the production of the fuel itself. We see in Southeast Asia where huge amounts of forest, native forest, are being cut down for the production of palm oil. That's going to have a devastating effect, I think, on first of all, on the global climate, but secondly, on biodiversity, and third, if there is a real need for, or if there's a desire for, the bioproducts that these plantings are going to produce.
And all of this comes at a time when there are increasing concerns about the availability of food, enough food, to feed the world's population.
That, of course, has been a question in the last few years especially. We're seeing reports now of out of Haiti of the dire situation that the people have found themselves there. But in Africa and in other developing countries and in regions where there has been and there continues to be, and the real fear is that the switch to more production of grains or plants that for production of biofuels, biochemicals, that will take away from the planting of food crops. And when that happens, when people see that they can make more money selling their corn for biofuel than to sell their corn for production of food, it's going to be a real problem throughout the food cycle and the food chain.
Popes Benedict and John Paul II have both challenged mankind to be conscientious caretakers of the environment, yet it seems that we've really been failing at that task. It's enough to look at the thick blanket of smog hanging over Beijing, the eroding canisters of toxic chemicals discarded in our oceans, to know that we haven't risen to the challenge posed to us by these popes. What courageous steps would the Vatican like to see the world governments take to protect our world and prevent climate change?
Well, it comes down to just this understanding that the world can only put up with so much, that the Earth can only deal with so much of our irresponsibility and our selfishness, that once mankind realizes that we can't freely dump into the rivers and the oceans, when we can't cut down forest to for whatever purpose, we're seeing that again in the situation in Haiti, where they have deforested such a large part of the country that the land just isn't sustainable anymore. It can't sustain a crop. It can't sustain protecting itself from runoff or whatever might come along. And so until, and that's one of the things that we push, that we teach in the church, is that the responsibility of mankind, that solidarity that Pope John Paul spoke of so often, that we are truly all in this together, and that we cannot tolerate anymore this selfishness, this unsustainable use of the natural resources of the earth, with the idea that we're going to do what we can now and not worry about the situation for future generations.
Is the Kyoto Accord on climate change obsolete?
Until we bring everyone in, I truly believe that it will never be as effective as it needs to be. Until, and to a limit, the developing countries have to be brought into the obligations of Kyoto or some other treaty that might be devised, that might be workable. I don't know the percentages. I don't know the numbers. I know that we haven't met the obligations, or that we're not on a track to meet the obligations of Kyoto.
Notwithstanding the culpability of industrialized nations like the United States, the biggest culprits or polluters are the emerging third world countries such as China and India. And now we're, of course, seeing the former Soviet bloc states making an industrial comeback with outdated technology. To what extent is it the responsibility of the international community to help poorer nations acquire environmentally safe industries and practices?
That's one of the questions that the international community has wrestled with for so many years, where on one hand, the developed countries are working so diligently in bringing these developing countries forward, where at the same time, there's a reluctance to provide, in many cases, the technology that might be needed to take that great next step. And we see that as these developing countries exercise their right to development, that some of the practices that they use are not sustainable. And so there has to be a balance agreed to and held between the idea of right to development and a right to use the resources that are available, rather than to find new sources of energy or new sources of production that aren't so detrimental to the environment.
China recently surpassed the U.S. as the biggest producer of greenhouse gases, and many nations are calling on Beijing to do more to curb emissions. The United Nations has called on wealthy nations to give $10 billion annually over the next 3 years to help poor countries, much to be used to build things like seawall barriers and infrastructure to combat rising sea levels or the effects of drought.
The Holy See, in its own small way, is trying to diminish the size of its environmental footprint by installing solar panels on the audience hall's roof, introducing a variety of energy-saving and environmentally friendly cooling and heating services. Do you see the Vatican acting as an example for others to follow, whether they be businesses or governments?
I think to a point, yes, that now they had the kickoff for the celebration of the new solar panels on the audience hall. I'm just not certain. I've read two different items, or we talk about these things, how much energy that's going to provide for the Vatican or for the audience hall itself. But it is going to be an example for people to see that, you know, you have this space, whether it's solar energy, wind energy, hydro, whatever it might be, that we do truly have to take those next steps in finding alternative sources of energy.
Yet most of these emerging energy-saving and environmentally friendly technologies are very costly to the average person to install. So what is the answer?
I think initially costly, but from what I understand, that these solar panels will pay for themselves in a few years through energy saving, that an array of wind turbines, although the initial capital outlay is a great deal of money, that they can generate the electricity to pay for themselves and become a cost-saving measure. So it's the initial outlay, it's the initial cost that we have to deal with, and maybe to bite the bullet, as it would be, in other ways, so that we might pay for the development of a new nuclear facility. It's terribly expensive, hugely expensive. But when we see the impact that it might have on providing people with the electricity that they need, or cutting the use of fossil fuels, I think that, and the Holy See believes that it would be worth it in the long run.
I cambiamenti epocali avvenuti negli ultimi 50 anni evidenziano come nel difficile crocevia.
Speaking in July 2007 on the 50th anniversary of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, Pope Benedict recalled the Holy See's membership in the agency since its founding and its commitment to its goal of accelerating and enlarging the contribution of atomic energy to peace, health, and prosperity throughout the world.
Per un autentico sviluppo rispettoso dell'ambiente e sempre attento alle popolazioni più svantaggiate.
With regard to nuclear power, the Pope said favoring the peaceful and safe use of nuclear technology for authentic development, respectful of the environment and attentive to the most disadvantaged populations, is always relevant and urgent.
A vantaggio di tutti gli abitanti, in primo luogo dei più poveri.
But hand in hand with nuclear development, says Monsignor Reinhardt, is the need to develop environmentally safe methods of disposing of nuclear waste.
Well, again, it's something that has to be developed. It's something that we have to find the answers for it. We can't just continue in the non-sustainable use of and then. The unfortunate thing, the disposal of some of these things, that along with the development and along with the use, we have to find ways to lessen the impact.
Monsignor James Reinhardt is an official with the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. They followed him in life and became his voice after his death. Christ's apostles went forth to spread the good news to the four corners of the earth after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Some stayed close to the Holy Land, but others, like Paul and Peter, traveled farther afield. I asked Father Bernie O'Connor of the Pontifical Council for Eastern Churches, where did Christ's disciples end up? Some, like Thomas, went as far east as India. And just what was an apostle in biblical times?
Certainly in the Hebrew scriptures, what Christians refer to as the Old Testament, and in the non-religious literature of the era, we find the reference to an apostle as one who's delegated, who's sent forth on a mission. Particularly to a foreign country. The term actually comes from Greek and literally means that. So if I were ruler of an area, I may want to send my delegate to another king or to a subservient area under my jurisdiction to collect taxes. So the sending forth the delegation becomes the basis of your notion of apostle. Now, among Jesus' disciples, you see the term becoming nuanced. And it's always very important to remember that terms such as apostle and bishop and of that nature are never complete and entire at any one point in time. That the understanding and the development of the term is evolutionary, it's progressive. Well, what do we see about the 12, as they're called in the New Testament. We see a variety of continuity points. They too are delegated. Christ himself was a delegate from God, an apostle, according to the letter to the Hebrews. We're told that the apostles delegated subordinates to go out and teach in their name also. Barnabas, for example, in the Acts of the Apostles. So basic bottom line, when we hear the term used in the New Testament, what are we talking about? A special vocation, a kind of formal appointment from the Lord to a determined office with connected authorities and duties, and to go forth and spread the Christian message. So when Judas committed his treason, and the apostles had to assemble to choose a successor, Matthias, what were they looking for? They wanted someone who was a witness of Christ, who had been with him in a certain sense. St. Paul picks up on this and said he was not with Jesus in his ministry, but witness to the resurrection. Yes, this was a person who would be a herald of the gospel, who would be sent forth, who would have a role of healing and a role of casting out demons. It's kind of strange to our mentality. But think of it as reconciler, one who looks at those things that thwart our being, that frustrate and anger and divide us as people. And the apostles are those who want to bring healing physically, spiritually, socially to this kind of setting. So basic bottom line, the function of an apostle to govern, to preach doctrine as a witness, to administer the sacred rites, to make laws, to speak with authority, to provide successors to their own number, even to act in a way that would appear to be punitive, to a corrective healing measure in the community. Now, in terms of after the resurrection, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because people think they just sat around Jerusalem and awaited the inevitable. They didn't. They took very seriously a wonderful line that we find in the last conclusion to the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew 28:20, and he says, "Go forth, teach all nations." Well, they did. "Baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit." They did. "And I'm with you until the end of time." They are. So it goes on. Some of the apostles, well, Peter, for example, what does he do? He goes to Asia. He comes to Rome. He dies under the Emperor Nero and is buried up the street.
In the Vatican.
In the Vatican.
That's right.
We have Bartholomew, who dies as a martyr in Armenia. We have St. Paul, who for 35 years runs around all over Asia, certainly Western Europe too. And of course, he dies. St. Paul's outside the walls.
Here in Rome.
Exactly. We have Jude, who goes to Mesopotamia and who goes to Edessa. And we have St. Thomas. And St. Thomas, among other places, goes to India.
Okay, we've only done 5 of the apostles. Do you know where some of the other ones went?
A number of them stayed relatively close to what we would call the Holy Land. But within that context, they went all over the area of what we would know as the Middle East. A number of them left Jerusalem, for example, went out, came back. So you have James dying in the Jerusalem area and a number of apostles dying in the vicinity. But the idea of going forth is a persistent theme, and sometimes in regions well beyond their local territories, as in the case of Thomas.
Now, you mentioned Thomas. It was Thomas, the big apostle that we all remember as the doubting Thomas. Now, why did he choose to go to India as his destination? And would you say that was a good choice for him?
I think given the climate of the time, it was a remarkable, obvious choice. For example, we know that as early as probably the reign of the Jewish king Solomon in the 10th century, there were trade relations with India. There's all kinds of references in secular literature, such as Pliny in the 2nd century of the Christian era, who talks about for centuries there have been continual relationships of Malabar ships visiting the Persian Gulf and Aden, the Red Sea and Egypt and into Rome. and even complaints that a little too much attention was being paid to them, that in fact maybe the trade relations had to be reviewed from time to time. Again, we see this through various early Roman authors and historians. Certainly in the case of a Christian apostle, it'll be logical to also want to go to an area which had well-known, well-recognized, well-established Jewish communities, as India did in the first century.
Really?
And it appears that Paul went to those areas foremost among all of those areas he did visit.
So they would have also spoken Hebrew.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they would have been familiar with the local culture and the people who were living there at the time. They probably opened many doors of welcome and hospitality, even though by this period, of course, Christianity was being seen as a heretical sect of Judaism and was not being entirely welcomed everywhere.
Now, I know that in the literature, it is sort of Thomas's presence in India is kind of seen more as legendary than as having a real physical archaeological proof that he was there. Or am I wrong?
I think your point is very well taken.
What evidence do we have that he actually lived and worked there?
I think there's a number of solid points of evidence. For one thing, we have to, I think, put aside the notion that evidence is only constituted by written documentation. We forget the longevity and the accuracy of oral tradition. And I'm going to give you an example outside this context. A very famous author, Alex Haley, in the United States of America, wrote an international book called Roots. And, of course, he wanted to find his roots, and he did so through pursuing oral tradition, which remained intact in the areas of Africa from which his ancestors originated. It was not a documentary source. It was an oral tradition source. In the same way, we have likewise venerable traditions in India, and also other forms of evidence I think we have to take seriously. We'll give you some example. It is very, very common in early ballads and art forms, even among Hindu culture, to celebrate Thomas. He was well known among various cultures other than Christian and Jewish within the Indian setting, and this is consistent. We find reference in the Syriac, Latin, and Greek fathers of the early church. Figures such as St. Ephrem speak of the unbroken tradition going back to St. Thomas. We have a strong Jewish presence, as I mentioned, since probably the 10th century BC. So it is absolutely logical that a Christian figure of the status of an apostle would have gone there, given this great continuity. We have, in the earliest liturgies that of which we're aware, there have always been commemorations of the presence of Thomas and the role of St. Thomas. And we also know that historically there have been several Christian communities in India which appear to have their roots in the era that we associate with him. And then the tomb itself, it was excavated well by the Portuguese in the 16th century, but it was spoken about even by figures like Marco Polo in the 13th century, who said from time immemorial, Christian pilgrims and other non-Christians have venerated the tomb of the Apostle Thomas. So when you put all these factors together and then add to them the very specific oral traditions within the Christian community, I think the burden of evidence is solid and it is persuasive.
Father Bernard O'Connor is an official at the Pontifical Council for Eastern Churches. And that brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.